Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. There's a big difference between a solution that measures a fundraiser's performance and a solution that helps a fundraiser perform. QBAC helps fundraisers to excel at their most critical task, developing deep, meaningful relationships with donors and cultivating them into lifelong givers. Give your fundraisers a better qualified portfolio, one that considers more than just capacity and simple scoring. Your fundraisers will also get insights into the hearts, minds, and connections of their donors. Fundraisers have a tough job. Help them close bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Podcast listeners, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow is finally back on the schedule. We have several dates confirmed. Since 2014, our team has been providing high-quality one-day roadshows in partnership with nonprofit leaders who want to showcase their space and provide thought-provoking and highly interactive fundraising training in their nonprofit community. Our roadshows have been described by our guest as hands down the best professional development experience that they have ever been a part of. This experience has been described as challenging assumptions with conversation-inspiring content and new ways of thinking. If you would like to register for one of the upcoming stops on the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, just visit the link in the show notes. Hi, Paulina. I am delighted to have you with me as my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have just met. We've agreed to coordinate our schedules here at the last minute. You're just coming off of a staycation. We totally all get what that is. And so I'm really grateful that you found the very back end of your week back in the office to have this conversation with me. And we're going to be talking a little bit. I'll make sure that everybody knows about the upcoming roadshow that's going to be in Austin. You're in Austin and friends with the organizations that are hosting. So I'm just delighted that we've got this few minutes to talk. Paulina, would you mind just before we dive into our topic of conversation, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. I'm so delighted to be here. My name is Paulina Artieda. I am the executive director of The New Philanthropist, and we're an organization that helps nonprofit boards become more diverse, inclusive, and equitable. So we're based out of Austin, Texas. We primarily work in Austin, Texas, but yeah, a lot of our work can go, you know, outside of Austin. So yeah, it's been quite a ride. I love the work I do.
Yeah, so I suspect our conversation is going to drift a little bit in that direction, but you've got to unpack what the new philanthropy. When I saw that, I got on your website. I thought, okay, this organization has a story similar to our friends at Mission Capital who are hosting the event. But tell us in 2 minutes, tell us what the story is there. That's fascinating.
Sure. Well, you know, as you might know, there's data out there for sure. It's primarily that most nonprofit boards, it's about 84%. I think it was a board source leading with intent in 2017. They put out some information that 2021 actually, that 78% of boards, 70% identify as white or Caucasian board members.
Sure.
And so when we look at the demographics of who they serve, we know that there's a diversity gap there. And so what we primarily focus on is bringing that lived experience so that the decision makers of those organizations that carry out everything from budget decisions to program decisions to even just in general resource decisions, they are really representing and making those decisions in line with what is that community going through, what connection they have to that community. And so when you're not representing or you don't have that lived experience or that diversity of thought, it's really hard to make those decisions with the most thought and insight and the best interest at hand for them. So we're there to do that and to create cultural shifts as well within that leadership in order to ultimately serve those communities at best. And we do that in many ways, but predominantly it's in three ways. We do leadership development for leaders of color and help women gain access and opportunity to boards. We work with nonprofit boards and help them create those cultural shifts through DEI training and in general, just redefining practices. And then we do board matchmaking. So we also bring them two together and helping them in meaningful ways make those connections of bringing leaders of color onto nonprofit boards.
Okay, so I know where we're going. I know where you come from, as do our listeners, and I have to first and let me make sure that you're so I had Madge on the podcast here. They're hosting the roadshow next week, and I had them. So your organization and Mission Capital, in many ways, are very complementary. I have to imagine that there's because a lot of what they're talking about is a capacity builder organization. Their aspirations are very consistent with yours. So, Paulina, we ask our guests to come on here with a big idea or bold opinion. I don't necessarily always know exactly what that opinion is, and we let the conversation emerge from there. Sometimes when I'm meeting a new friend like you, I sort of on my toes, and I'm like, okay, let's see where this is going to go. So, what do you got for us today?
Ooh, and I just love that. I love that you present it this way. So my question or big bold opinion is really around how can we redefine fundraising or fundraising practices through, you know, equity and inclusion and in a sense the practicing and the values behind equity and inclusion.
Yeah. So, Paulina, we talk about that. So I teach a lot of my listeners know that I teach two sections of the nonprofit management course over at the local college in the spring. And that's one of those conversations that we're more consistently having. And I can tell you it's sort of creates sort of a mind-boggling conversation, depending on the mix of my students in the classroom, because I'm able to bring I'm just sort of putting some layering onto this. I'm able to bring an awareness of sort of who the donor is historically for most organizations and who someone like myself and yourself might want the donor to be in the future. And those are two very different donors. Am I right?
Well, yeah. And let's take a step back and look at this historically, right? How that, in a sense, structure was set up. So me growing up and looking at boards in general or nonprofits in general, when it came to leadership or those boards, I definitely did not see anyone like there on there that looked like me. I didn't feel included, and it felt very much like a wealth circle, like wealthy people that wrote big checks.
Yes.
And so it didn't feel like a place that I belonged. And even as I went through my career, it wasn't necessarily that I was ever asked to join a board. I felt like I had to really be able to write $5,000 checks to even be able to join. So it was almost like a pay to play kind of scenario, but also like a scenario of like, how many connections do I have in my network to really bring in some big money and big bucks? So that's the structure that's been very historical within the nonprofit sector. And while in a sense it served it for fundraising, it hasn't really served it for representation or lived experience, because not everyone can do that. And I think that's where we got to challenge those norms, right? And challenge how we can really restructure that and see if there's a way of even looking at older models that have existed within communities of color where fundraising is prevalent, when money does come in, just not necessarily in those ways or those norms that have happened.
So, Paulina, when I started in fundraising 25 years ago, I probably recall, you know, probably one of those sort of fundraising 101 workshops or how to get your board into whatever that, you know, whatever that initial track that we all got into. a lot of us heard that old mantra of get, give, or get off. And I don't think this would have been right around the turn of the century when I got into fundraising. I don't think any of us realized that we were, when we say that, and I'm guessing you would agree with me, when we say give, get, or get off, we're essentially saying make sure that your board is, generally older white people, generally older white wealthy people, and some communities are diversifying and the wealth is certainly not all held in the hands of white people. That's a stereotype that we can probably unpack. But is that one of those things that we have to unravel and realize that give, get, or get off is probably not necessarily the criteria with which we want to recruit to our board?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the many, right? I mean, it's give, get, or get off, or it's also, unlimited term limits.
Yeah.
No limits, right? Passing down your board chair, from family member to family member or colleague to colleague, the good old referral system.
To where
not necessarily, you bring in somebody outside of your silo. And that can keep that well circle very close knit as well, right? So the give and get, I mean, it's something that it's a barrier. It's a barrier for many. Because, and I think it's reported somewhere that even with a give and get off, most board members don't necessarily meet all that.
No.
And so it's almost like, not everyone pays all of it or even pays it at all, yet we're still not offering those type of those opportunities for people that can share that lived experience or those insights and still raise plenty of money for that organization, right?
Is that, Paulina, some of the training that we do at Responsive, some of the training that we do is we basically, one of the things I'm always saying when it comes to boards, I'm like, let your boards just generally let them off the hook because you're absolutely convinced that your boards are going to do things that they're not actually going to do. And I don't think I have ever worked for or consulted with a board that ever fulfilled that. I mean, is that some of it that you're just deconstructing just completely flawed assumptions anyway, that 40, 50, 80, whatever percentage of your board, they're not going to live up to these crazy expectations anyway, no matter who they are.
Exactly. I mean, I think we have to relook at this whole model and see what works and what doesn't work in an equitable way. Is it a certain amount that needs to be fulfilled, or is it what can you give? What can you give in a meaningful way that works for you? How do we define currency? Is there social currency that you
need? Yeah.
Is there skill set currency? Some nonprofits actually need skill sets and actual in-kind services of talent to come in and be the legal services that you need on there. And that is worth money, right? Lived experience is valuable. It is the currency. And so it's really redefining what that currency is, as well as the network. Your one connection of, maybe somebody in tech is just as valuable as 30 people in the community that are community activists that will give just as much, right? If anything, the awareness builds even more in that side, right? So it's redefining on what this give and get is and why is that necessary and structured in a way where it's based on the highest amount wins or looks the best or is held to be the this power dynamic of being the one with the most. And so I think that's where we need to look at bylaws, we need to look at practices and just rethink this through equity again.
Yeah.
Inclusion. And really see what works.
I've spent a lot of time, most of my listeners know that I've been working on a writing project about how a lot of the marketplace logic and consumer logic sort of creeps into the nonprofit sector and gets in our way. And it didn't occur to me until I'm sort of simmering here on this conversation that we're having, that in many ways we've commodified board membership because we've essentially said, buy your privilege to sit on this board. And that's my overall critique about the way that we've done a lot of things when it comes to the nonprofit sector and fundraising in particular, is we're basically saying buy this privilege to sit on the board. So where are you seeing this work? Like, what are the exciting case studies where you're seeing this work?
You know, I'll tell you, it's the smaller BIPOC-led nonprofits that are really testing this out. And I'll say testing this out because there is no right model right now, right? There is no model that says this works. But the beauty part of it is even our, you know, within eUphilanthropist, even our own board, we're figuring this out as we go.
Sure.
We're redefining our bylaws as much as we can legally, right? Because there are all legalities around how much you can do. And how we can not only like, so for example, with us, we will never have a gala. That's just not who we are, not how we want to be inclusive of the community we serve.
Yep.
A gala is just going to always kind of bring into the system of hierarchy, right?
Yep.
With that we don't represent as an organization. And so we want it to be more of a community celebration. So it's even choosing the language with fundraising. What is that language that you're choosing when you push this out? When you even talk about the community you serve, what is that language that you're using when you're talking to donors? That itself needs to be very much more honoring and culture honoring versus exposing of stories that may not be putting them in the best light or just in general how we tell stories about the communities that are being served. So I think it's really bringing in that lived representation, bringing in those insights, but also questioning everything that has been a part of just in general, the norms of fundraising and really seeing what is, who's at the table and who's not and why, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not at the table, asking yourself why and what's keeping them from the table. If it's a fundraising practice, like they can't for some reason, provide $5,000 for their dues, then you need to question that and basically redefine that. If it's because they need to fundraise or they need to have fundraising skills or connections, let's redefine that because that's a barrier that it's just that can be rethought into how there are many other ways that they can bring in those types of connections or bring in other skill sets that can bring you connections, right?
Paulina, are there people? So if I'm thinking about my own experience, I've sat on boards and I've not sat on boards. And I've sat on boards that soon after I was on them, I was like, okay, I don't really want to do this anymore. But I have to imagine that there's plenty of people like myself. So I sort of fit in that privileged white spot, right? And I have to imagine there's people like myself that if I walked into a board meeting for the first time and it's made up of everybody that looks like me, I tend to think that there's probably a lot of my peers in this space and our peers, your peers and my peers, they're going to react. I don't want to be on that board. That's not the board I'm looking to be a part of. It's not a norm. It's not a norm that seems acceptable to me anymore. Are you finding that the person who usually like me might sit on a board is saying, I don't want to be on that board anymore if they all just look and live like me?
I live in Texas. Don't forget that.
Yes, I know. But you live in Texas, but you live in Austin, Texas. You're not in Dallas, Texas, and you're not in Houston. So,
it's interesting. I think, absolutely. Now that is being questioned a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we are having, 2020 was of course, a year that had us all question everything around us, but also I think little by little, even foundations are starting to push back a lot more on nonprofits, the demographics of their boards and so forth.
Yeah.
There is this want of making sure that there's just more diversity of thought, right? Of thought in general.
Yeah.
Of taking care of communities in better ways. And so the biggest hangup though I see is that most nonprofits don't know how. How do we diversify our board?
Okay.
How do we get started? Yeah. And it's and I can totally empathize with that, because it's like you don't want to be in that weird space of tokenism. Like, do we just go up to, you know, people of color and be like, do you want to join our board? You're black. Can you do that? And it's
right, of course.
You don't want to ever do that. Do not ever do that. Right. Of course. But I always take it back to, like, you build relationships, right? That's what it comes down to, whether you're looking for new board members or not. It's all about building relationships. Do not expect people to come to you. You have to go out and you have to build and forge relationships. And that may be with affinity groups that specifically serve communities of color. They may be with other organizations, sister organizations that serve communities of color. So it's really about getting out there. And if you're uncomfortable doing that, you find friends to go do that with, or you find, you learn new skills around that. So it's really about building relationships, but it's also about understanding how to create cultural shifts on your board, because even as you bring in new board members, it doesn't mean the problem is solved, right? There's that inclusion factor that will completely discourage people of color from continuing to serve on that board. Because just because you're on a board and you got asked to be on a board doesn't mean that you will come across microaggressions. You will come across, these biases and feel like you're just there to be there and to check off a box. So there has to be this want of wanting to change those dynamics and wanting it to be more inclusive.
So, Paulina, are you seeing yourself, because of the type of organization that you're representing, and I only ask this because I've done this myself in some of my placement work with development officers, fundraisers, I have been able to say to candidates, women of color in particular, I really, you're amazing, and this would be a great opportunity for you, but putting you in this role is going to set you up. I mean, are you finding yourself in that similar place where you're talking to, say, a woman of color as it relates to an opportunity to sit on this board, you know, whatever that board happens to be, and you're like, that, you know, you're going to be a token. You're just there to sort of play a part that they want you to play. I mean, I remember a conversation I had with a previous podcast guest, a woman of color, and she's basically saying, I don't want to play that token role. And I'm going to be counting on people. That's the role I was playing with this particular candidate. I was like, you don't want this job. You don't want this job. And this was my client at the time.
We do not want to cause more harm. Right.
Yeah.
So for that reason, like, one of our approaches is to bring that leadership development. And when I say leadership development, is not to help leaders of color become better leaders and skill sets, but it's become better leaders through DEI. Right.
Yeah.
And that is to help them understand how to navigate those spaces where they will maybe, or most likely encounter some of those instances of tokenism, and how to handle those instances in a way where it favors them, where it, in a sense, helps them come to a conclusion where they are less harmed. And it also helps them create allyships to where they can be a part of that cultural shift and change. So it empowers them to let them know that the cultural values, the leadership cultural values that they bring to the table are important, are needed, they should be wanted. And that itself, that little piece of confidence makes such a huge difference in how they even serve, because they want to serve. And so I think just by bringing in that training and those workshops that we do, it's really given them the ease to want to even just, you know, yeah, I know that I'm going to face some of these issues, but I'm going to be okay. And they know that we are going to be a continuous resource throughout their journey in board leadership. That's not a problem. They know that we're there for them. So I think that's one piece. The other piece is that when we do board matching, we're very clear in asking, everything centered around the board prospect of color. So everything centered around, where do they want to go? Do they want to go on to a nonprofit that has had some DEI training, or one that's at a beginner stage, or one that's completely advanced? And we're never going to put them in match them with a nonprofit that they don't wish to, like, you know, like, I don't want anybody who's just starting out. I want somebody advanced. Then we're going to make sure that happens.
Yeah. So let's shift gears for a minute and talk about the, because this is something that I've wrestled with some of my guests, and I still haven't gotten transition. So it's essentially the DEI conversation that we've been routinely having here on the podcast tends to be centered around board, you know, the board dynamics, who's in what seats on the board, the executive director seats, you know, who's in the leadership seats. It was a remarkable, you know, I think that's a remarkable story to have listened to Madge talk last week about her role in leadership there at Mission Capital and other places. But changing the demographics of our donor pools is a long, in my mind, is just a longer term strategy that has to be committed to over the long haul. Am I right?
Okay, so I think this is something that, you know, for the new philanthropists, we've challenged ourselves with a couple of things. Well, one, we know that historically fundraising has been there, again, in not the norm ways that we look at fundraising. Like if you look at communities, there's been fundraising through faith organizations, right? Yes. Or through your community, like events, right? So fundraising has always been there through those donors.
Yes.
Right? Is there just not accounted for? Those stories are not told under that fundraising lens, I guess you could say.
Right.
And money has been raised. Tons of money.
Yeah.
So I think it's just more about how do you include those donors within your scope of fundraising, where it's a relevant connection, not just come and figure out the system of fundraising. It's more like, no, let's shift our system of fundraising to include how those donors already know how to give money.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one way. And the other way that we've really kind of looked at fundraising for us is fundraising with engagement, right? Because I think what we've seen now, especially for us that we have a younger fundraising pool, is that the donors don't just want to give money, but they want to be involved in meaningful ways, especially with our work, where it's very much more centered around even systemic change, right? They don't want to just give money. They want to be a part of that movement. And so very much like, for example, we have a corporate membership program where we raise funds through corporations. But a part of that is we're asking corporations to, one, help us identify how many board members do you have in your business? How many of your employees are board members, right? And if not, let's start giving them, you know, let's start providing workshops to bring board awareness to those ERG groups or IRG groups.
Yes.
And so that engagement piece is already starting a donor-based pool for us of where not only are they engaging with us through that awareness, building of board awareness, but also on how they're finding a cause or a community engagement piece through us on how to give back to other organizations and become involved through their leadership skills. And not only volunteering as a board leader, but then from there, there's like, you know, tentacles of networking and them spreading the word about different organizations that they want to share where they're being leaders at. And so it's always about the heart and the why, right? And the why is as much as important to us from a board leader to just a regular donor who's giving money. Why is, and how can we tap into that why in a different way in that engagement piece?
I had a woman of color speaking to my students a couple of years ago about an intentional pursuit of donors of color. So she was in a major gifts officer role, and I invited her in. She and I had worked together before, and I knew that she would bring this up because I admired what she was doing. But she, you know, in an effort to diversify the pool, I would guess that she was in a traditional quote unquote major gifts officer type role with an assigned portfolio of donors, and she described to me, or described to our students, sort of a subtle, I don't know how explicit she was with her employer, but she was, you know, she was recruiting donors of color into the organization. You know, she was kind of like what we were talking about a few minutes ago with the, you know, she doesn't walk up to the donor and say, "Will you give us, you know, $500 because you're black?" She was pursuing relationships, with donors. Is that the type of conversations organizations are having, or is that a direction we're going to end up going? Is that we're going to pursue donors in order to diversify our pools of donors? We're going to be more deliberate, just like we've been deliberate in the past with, you know, I mean, when I started this, Paulina, you know this, when I started this work 25 years ago, we were looking at zip codes and we knew who the zip, you know, we knew where people lived and what kind of affluence they had. Are we moving in that direction or is there something else out there?
You know, I think again, it's like you mentioned, relationship building. I think it's transparency, because the minute you walk away from trying to be transparent, people can smell right away.
Right, you're right.
Like,
yes.
Don't try to fool me.
Yes.
It's also, it's like community building, like how it's showing up at the community. It's showing up at the place of breaking bread. It's not necessarily expecting donors to come to you.
Yeah.
It's so key to do that. It's super key. It's, and you know, it's going to take effort, but I think it's such a huge learning experience. It's not only learning experience in terms of you, like learning about different cultures, but different ways of leadership, right? You learn about different leadership, about different traditions, about different, just community insights, as well as you show up and you show that you care, you become involved, and it has to be an authentic part of you showing up. It can't be just because you're checking off a list. You have to want to do that. And your donor, and then they will show up for you. You know, it's very much gonna, as long as you're transparent, you're there to build relationships and you're there because you really care. The buy-in and the give back is going to be very, very much more, right? But you have to be willing to do that. And you have to be willing to do that in a way where it's significant. Right. It can't be a one-off too. It can't be just one time that you do that. It has to be very much intentional. Like you said, ongoing way of building that relationship.
You know, I remember a conversation I had with a very affluent individual who's providing advice in the fundraising community. She's a very wealthy donor and she gives money. And one of the conversations she and I had, Lisa is her name, Lisa Greer. She and I had this conversation on the podcast about the idea that to get really good at this, this is probably where I always wanted fundraising to be. And maybe part of this conversation that we're having, this sort of the shared conversation that we're all having, it'll get there. What she and I sort of centered around is we have to learn how to go about things indirectly. You can't come at people because they fit a particular profile, and you can't necessarily come at them because they're rich and wealthy and live in the right neighborhood. You have to learn how to come through that, you know, that indirect sort of way, and you got to come through it in relationship. And if you don't know how to do it, you're probably not going to be very good at this work. I mean, is that basically what we're talking about?
I mean, at the core, yes.
Right. She's a very affluent, you know, she's one of the 1%, lives in Beverly Hills. She's published a book. She's told the world that she's got wealth, but she's also saying on my podcast, look, you're not going to be able to come at me and just say, I want to build a relationship with you because you're rich. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. I'm not going to be able to recruit you, Paulina, to my board just because, you know, you're a woman of color. It's not going to work.
Right. You can smell right through it.
Yeah, we're going to have to genuinely want to be in relationship.
Yeah. You're going to really, you know, you're going to show up at the new philanthropist events and really care about what I do through that organization. You're going to want to sit and have coffee with me and really learn about me and who I am and why. You know, you're just going to have to get to know me a little better. And it's not going to be, it's going to have to be genuine, right? And I think it's just also, I'm not saying that it's beyond relationship building, but it's because it has to be a lifestyle for you, okay? DEI is a lifestyle. It's not meant to be a formula that you take into effect.
Right.
It's meant to be, this is how I want to see the world, okay? You diversify your dollar. Okay, which means you support businesses of color throughout, which means you go and eat at different places. It's not the norm, the most best. It's not the most, the top 10 restaurants that always get featured that are all white owned. It's all different types of restaurants. You definitely want to make sure that as an influencer or as a leader, you open doors for all, right? That you have conversations that are deep rooted with all. It's just, it's a matter of reading books from different perspectives, of having art hang on in your home from different artists. So I think the more you can tap into how this becomes a lifestyle, the easier it will come to you, right? It won't be such a awkward way of operating. It will be a fluid way of who you are as a person. And so one of the things we do when we work with nonprofit boards is every board member takes an assessment, a cultural competency assessment.
Yeah.
And so that cultural competency assessment is going to let you know where you are within the spectrum of phases of how well you adapt with cultures. And you get a work plan based on that, like based on where you're at. This is what you can do to help move up that spectrum of becoming more adaptive to cultures and become more just fluid in that space of you know, being able to understand and integrate within cultures, different cultures. And I think that work plan is what's necessary for everyone, right? Because I feel like it can be very awkward, but once you understand and hold that empathy, which empathy is probably the most important word that we can all use nowadays, the more you can have that, I think the more it will be just a part of who you are and making those relationships happen and just showing up and learning, having a curiosity around these things is what it is.
So I know some of my listeners, and I know some of them are itching to have this asked. Does the rich white guy still have a place on the board?
Absolutely. I mean, our philosophy is not let's take people away. It's how do we add seats to the board, right?
I like that.
How can we add more seats to the board?
Yeah.
And I think that's important. We want to add more lived experience. We want to add more insights. We want it to just be a great conversation of different perspectives. So I do think the rich white man should still have a seat on the board. I just also think that you know, definitely don't lead by your instinct. Your gut instinct.
Yeah.
Because that can normally, you know, lived experience, if you don't have the lived experience in that space when it comes to communities of color, you don't lead, as a white person, don't lead by your instinct is my piece of advice. Because you don't have the lived experience to lead by your gut instinct.
I have to imagine the aspiration is in the midst of the pandemic, when there were a lot of these conversations were starting to simmer up and really becoming top priority. I repeatedly said that I sensed what I referred to as sort of a qualitative turn in our fundraising aspirations, that we were sort of qualitatively looking at all the myriad of things that we do, and we were going to get qualitatively better at it. Because there's, you know, I think about the community I live in here. I live in a rich white man's town, and I got to be, you know, I know enough of them that they're tired of being recruited to boards because they're a rich white man. I mean, that's been their experience too. Is look, I know you know what's in my pocketbook, and that's why you're recruiting me to this board. And so maybe we're all just going to get, you know, Paulina, 5 years out, are we just going to have all gotten better at this?
You know, I say that if you're tired of being asked, I think it's one of those opportunities to become an ally in this piece of work, where you start very much your journey of how you can open doors for others, but not just open and introduce, but open and mentor others into board service. Because I think that's you know, our mentorship program has been a phenomenal program for the new philanthropists, but I see that it's needed all across. Like, it's not just like it's just needed for leaders of color. Mentorship onto boards is like, whether you're a person of color or not, you probably should just have. A lot of that board service can be intimidating for all. So I think it's an opportunity as an ally become a mentor in that space of bringing in new leadership into boards and introducing more people into.
Oh, that's boards. So, okay. Okay. I don't want to miss that. And that's a great point to, cause I don't want to miss what you just, the advice you just gave. I don't want my listeners to miss that. So the old white guy here in central Pennsylvania, who's routinely getting invited to be on boards, you're suggesting to him, that's totally insightful. Stop accepting board seats and become an advocate and ally to putting people who don't look like you in those seats and convincing those boards who are coming to you. Correct me if I'm articulating this, but that's so insightful. And it's very simple too. Mr. Smith, when somebody asks you to go on a board, refer them to somebody who looks like Paulina rather than somebody who looks like Jason, and help that and help Paulina maybe shine in that role better than Jason might. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Mentor them and give them the insights, you know, kind of check in on them along the journey and be like, hey, how's that board leadership position going?
I love that.
Questions.
Yeah.
Let me make sure I prep you a little bit. Let me tell you about the board dynamics on this board. I know 5 of the 10 people there. This is what you're going to have to look out for. This is so-and-so. You know, give them the insight that you already have because you've sat on all the different boards with all those other different people, you know, 10 times already. That's what's needed. It's that it's not only the mentorship, but it's almost that, again, that relationship building that you can give someone that heads up, right? And I promise you that what you're doing there is not only encouraging, but you're also teaching that person what they're going to do when they're ready to open doors and when they're ready to hand off their leadership position or their legacy to someone else.
So I have to imagine, Paulina, to wrap up on that thought, if an affluent white woman or man from Austin knocks on your door and says, I want to know how to do that role, like the smile on your face right now, that gets you excited. If somebody says, I want to learn how to sort of get out of the way or help open a door for someone else, you'd coach them along in how to do that?
Absolutely. We have workshops, the equity chair workshops that we have help you do that. Absolutely.
That's fascinating. Yes. That's
Or if they currently sit on a board, we can go and help their board understand how to do that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We're here for them.
Paulina, I always wrap up, people in roles like yours, I always wrap up with, so we get 150, 200 downloads a day on the entire library. And there's somebody listening today that might reach out to you and want to have a conversation. Who is that person you most likely want to hear from?
Oh my goodness. I want to hear from everyone, but if you really want to get involved with a new philanthropist and want to be a supporter and an advocate, you know, we want to hear, you know, from people that understand the complexity of our work as donors, that understand that, this takes time, that the change that we're looking to create has a ripple effect. So if you're someone that's looking to really make a change with us, whether it's through, you know, donating, whether it's through coming in and wanting to participate in our programming, whether it's referring a nonprofit board to us, please reach out to us. That's what we're looking for. We're looking to do it together. We cannot do this work alone. That's one thing I know. And that's why with Madge and Mission Capital, sorry about that. We got a fan.
Yeah, he's excited. Paulina, he heard me say that the conversation would be 40 minutes and he's been keeping a watch on the clocks.
Yeah, so we know that with Madge and Mission Capital, like, you know, our work we can't do alone. So the more the merrier. You know, we have an opportunity more than ever now to really make a change and just do this together. So yes. Please reach out to us. It's www.tnpaustin.org.
Paulina, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for finding the time on the back end of your week. Take care of that puppy, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.